Okay. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this section, which commemorates the centenary of organized international science cooperation and science diplomacy, one of the special sections of the International Science Council. I am Elisa Reis, by training a political scientist at MIT. Now I teach political sociology at the Federal University in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, where I also share the interdisciplinary network on inequality. This morning, I have the pleasure to see all my colleagues who accepted our invitation. I thank you very much for your kind acceptance. And I am calling my co-coordinator, co-organizer, Alik Ismail Zadar, who is senior scientist at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology and Research Professor at the Russian Academy of Science. I am currently the vice president of the International Science Council, and he is the secretary of the International Science Council. Alik, please, could you introduce our section?
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a really great pleasure that we have today this session here, session dedicated to 100 years, if it's possible to take 100, it's definitely much older. Something happens with mouse here. It's maybe this way, no, doesn't work. Your fingers are magic. Look, there is no mouse.
Because it was there.
Sorry, I can see. Okay. Right. Yeah, here.
It's going to be there, but no.
I see. Thank you very much. Well, centenary of the organized international science cooperation and science diplomacy. It's very difficult to trace the history when the international cooperation started. At the same time, we know that in preliminary form, it started by the end of the 19th century, when Professor Zuse, the president of the Austrian Academy of Sciences, invited several European academies, as well as US Academy, Imperial Russian Academy of Sciences and Japan Academy of Sciences, to join him in the meeting which was held in Wiesbaden in Germany, and to discuss the problems of the cooperation, research cooperation. Especially it was driven by the problems of the diplomacy. Why? One of the examples which were discussed at this first meeting was the problem of the measurements of the arc meridian in the African countries, controlled by three nations, France, Britain, and Germany. And they needed scientists to cross borders, to go and to measure it. That was one of the concerns of the meeting, and another one definitely was related, several of them, to science, joint scientific production. It started as the International Association of Academies in 1899. Unfortunately, this association existed until the 1914, before the Second World War started. Unfortunately, First World War started. Unfortunately, the First World War generated a big economical, as you know, the disruption in Europe, and on the basis, actually, in 1918, at the time when the many major European countries thought about the recovering from the world, the several academies met in London in 1918 and in Paris to discuss future of the science cooperation. Unfortunately, at that time, it was non-inclusive. meeting in meaning that only the allied countries came together. The Germany, Russians, and others who were on the other side of the war and were losers didn't participate in this meeting. Nevertheless, the first meeting, which we can trace the history of the organized cooperation and the beginning of this, started in Brussels. These 16 countries, 16 representatives of 16 academies and research councils came together into Brussels to start the International Research Council. At the same time, the eight unions, international unions, some of them already were set up actually a few months before, like the International Astronomical Union and International Union of Geodesy and Geophysics, were established, were formed there, and then everything moved quite nice. Actually, when I'm talking about it, I cannot tell how much International Science, International Research Council, and later ICSU, as well as International Social Science Council, contributed to the science development. Nevertheless, I will show you just a few examples. And I would like to tell that this particular International Research Council was established for 12 years initially, with the possibility to extend beyond the 12 years if they will find this cooperation is useful. It was the case. And in 1931, International Council for Scientific Unions were established because the nations decided that, well, its international unions play a significant role in the promotion of the international scientific cooperation, and I think the council should be dedicated to the cooperation. Well, what was achievements? Just a few which I know well. One of the brightest examples of the 20th century was International Geophysical Year. I am a geophysicist, not only because of it, but because it was a truly the unique event which brought together many countries at the time of so-called Cold War together. And it was a remarkable project, and not only, as I mentioned, it's bringing together scientists and their accomplishment in science, and also raises several major international initiatives. Many international programs were set up during this year and these years beyond this. For example, it's particularly the Soviet Union and later, in a few months, the United States launched the satellite. And the first satellite was launched in 1957 within the framework of the International Geophysical Year. By the way, who can read Russian, it is exactly written here that this program was set up within the framework of the International Science Council. Well, by the way, after 50 years, International Science Council developed a wonderful event to commemorate the 50 years of the International Geophysical Year. It was the International Polar Year, and actually the International Geophysical Year initially were considered as an international, third International Polar Year, and this was the fourth year international. Well, another is a very well-known program which was set up by the International Science Council late in 1996. International Council for Scientific Unions changed its title to the International Council for Science, and was the problems and understanding of the climatic and environmental change. And here, remarkable role played the Swedish meteorologist Bert Bolin, who convinced first ICSU, later World Meteorological Organization, and together they established the World Climate Research Program. Later on, it was recognized also the influence of the mankind, there is on the all environmental global change. That's why Bernd together with his colleagues and other scientists suggested another international program, which was called the International Geosphere Biosphere Program, which generated a lot of exciting research as well as World Climate Research Program. And in 2015, it merged with Future Earth. Important issue we have to mention was the importance of recognition of social scientists. After the Second World War, the UNESCO General Assembly adopted the resolution leading to the formation of the International Social Science Council, which really played a significant role in promoting the social science program and in understanding influence of society to major issue and how to, as specifically mentioned here, to study the implication of technological change. Since 2008, these two major natural, we can tell about ICSU and Social Council worked together. For example, one of the first joint major program was Integrated Research on Disaster Risk, which was established together with United Nations Office for Disaster Risk Reduction. Well, in 2018, just a year ago, International Science Council was established as a merger between these two councils. And after the 2 years discussion and the preparatory work, today it is a member organization of 142 members and about 40 international union associations, major interdisciplinary programs, affiliated members. You see the 30. Well, just very briefly, vision of the IC is a science for global public good, and the mission is to be global voice for science. I hope today that I already will tell more about this progress done during the 1+ year. And the strategic objective is promote international research scholarship, increase evidence-informed understanding decision-making, support the continued and equal advances of social rigor, protect scientific freedom and advocate principles of the responsible practice of science. We established four domains of challenge and opportunity. And again, I hope that Daya will highlight this in more detail. Finally, the international science cooperation and diplomacy is important, as we wrote recently, as we mark the centenary of the international research cooperation. Humanity faces its biggest challenge ever, living sustainably on the planet. It has never been more important for our society to understand and value science. That is all what I wanted to tell about history. Just a brief history. We are here today after more than 100 years. Our session not dedicated to history. Our session dedicated to future. But as a scientist, as a mathematician who use normally the inverse problem to understand this future and to look in the past and to understand the future, I specifically made this presentation about history. Just that is history, but we are looking to the future. That is why we invited today exciting speakers who will speak about future international research cooperation, about today, future research cooperation, maybe looking a few to the past, but it is absolutely not necessary. Future is our future. That's why now I would like to present our speakers, and I would like, when I will name them, I invite them to join us here. First, Daya Reddy. Daya Reddy holds the South African Research Chair in Computational Mechanics at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. He has served as President of Academy of Science of South Africa, and currently Daya Reddy is a President of International Science Council. Daya, please join us. Thank you. Stephanie Balm, She is a professor at Sciences Po Paris School of International Affairs and she is a dean of the Collège Universitaire at Sciences Po. She is a former science attaché at the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Please, Stéphanie, join us. Jean-Pierre Bourguignon is a French mathematician and the president and chair of Scientific Council of the European Research Council. Previously, Jean-Pierre was a president of the Société Mathématique de France and of the European Mathematical Society. Please join us, Jean-Pierre, at this podium. The Honorable Alexander Klunov is a Russian physicist appointed in 2013 the Director General of the Russian Science Foundation by a decree of the Russian President. Earlier, he kept positions as the Deputy Minister of Education and Science for the Russian Federation, Director General of the Department for Science, High Technology and Education at the Government of the Russian Federation, and Head of Division of Science and Education Policy at the Russian President's Executive Office. Alexander Vitalievich, please join us. Yelena Manayenkova, she is a geographer and environmental scientist. Yelena, it was very difficult to really trace all degrees which you receive in many fields of earth sciences. That's why I told environmental scientists. And the Deputy Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization. If I am not wrong, you are the first female scientist at this position, at least as I know. She serves as Secretary of the World Meteorological Congress and Executive Council and oversees the World Meteorological Climate, Hydrology, Water Resources, Research and Gender Mainstreaming Programs. Elena, please join us. Thank you. Atish Dabholkar. He is a theoretical physicist from India and currently, just a few weeks, was appointed by the UNESCO Director General as a director of the Abdus Salam International Center for Theoretical Physics in Trieste, Italy. And he joined ICTP as a head of the High Energy Cosmology and Astropractical Physics section before assuming the directorship. Yeah, Atish, please join us. Thank you. Okay, again with mouse. Okay, problem. Well. Red, correct? Yesterday it didn't work as same because yesterday we were here. Not probably next year. I will use. Oh, yes. Thank you. After the. It's working. Thank you very much. Thank you very much that you agreed to join our session. And first of all, we would like to hear what do you think about the international science cooperation and the science diplomacy. And we would like to give a floor to you about the 5 minutes to speak and who prepared the presentation, definitely you are welcome. And we will start with Daya Reddy. Daya, please. Well, it's up to you. Yes.
I don't have a presentation. Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for being here. And Alec and Elisa, thank you very much for organizing a session on this very, very important centenary, which gives us an opportunity to reflect on what we have learned from the last 100 years about international cooperation, and importantly, how we need to go about this in the present and in the future. I'd like to make just a few comments convey some of my own thinking around the theme of this meeting, of the session rather. First of all, looking back, I think we gained some sense of the huge importance of international scientific cooperation in various spheres, including beyond science. And Alec has made reference to some examples. The nature of scientific cooperation has changed, has shifted in line with, shall we say, historical developments, whether it is world wars, the Cold War, and the like. But in all cases, it's been really important that scientists have found ways to come together, notwithstanding the ravages of war, the tensions that have existed between countries. This brings us to the topic, or the topic of science diplomacy. That is, science as a route to opening channels of communication where these might be very difficult, given political tensions, other differences. So, science as an enabler, and furthermore, scientific cooperation continuing, notwithstanding these difficulties that might arise. And there are many examples over the decades, coming right up to the present day, of excellent scientific cooperation involving scientists of different countries, which otherwise are as far apart ideologically and in other ways as one can imagine. And that is so important. I want to come back to the establishment of the foundation of ICSU in 1931. So we had the International Research Council. For me, one of the most important aspects of the establishment of ICSU was not only the inclusion of international scientific unions along with academies, or that we know, but also the fact that from that point on, the international scientific unions, the disciplinary unions, were on an equal footing with the academies. That was so important. And it paved the way for something that we discuss a lot today and which we realize is so important for the way in which we go about, particularly addressing global challenges as a community of scientists, and that has to do with multidisciplinarity. So here I think it's important, and it's a point I make over and over. Of course, I completely accept and I agree that multidisciplinary approaches to global challenges are extremely important. Multidisciplinary work is equally important within the scientific domain, but it can only be successfully executed if one has a strong disciplinary base. We can't approach the problems of today, the global challenges, in a truly trans or multidisciplinary way if we don't have the strong pillars of disciplinary work. And this is where the international scientific unions have been so important. If we fast forward to the establishment of the International Science Council, well, in 1952 we had the establishment of the International Social Science Council, but the importance of the merger just over a year ago was to go beyond simply saying, well, you know, cooperation and so on across all of the sciences, and actually to pull them all together so that the International Science Council's membership includes scientific unions that straddle the natural sciences, the social sciences, behavioral sciences, and the like. There are gaps for sure, there are disciplinary gaps, but nevertheless it is much broader than had been the case. And that is extremely important for as a basis for engaging effectively in approaching challenges from a multidisciplinary perspective. The final point I'd like to make comes back to international scientific cooperation and what we mean. Well, in one narrow sense, we mean literally that, scientists cooperating across boundaries. But I think we need to be aware that it should go beyond that. We need to be aware that we are a global scientific community, and there are members of our community, colleagues in parts of the world, who are completely marginalized. They are to some extent, you know, perhaps ignored, or the capacity for scientific work and cooperation in these countries is minimal. We must not forget them. For example, countries in the developing world, small island developing states and the like. So when we think and talk about international scientific cooperation and how to promote it, we need to think broadly, of course, beyond, you know, transcending geographical boundaries, but also becoming truly global in the way in which we think and in which we work. I'll leave it at that for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Daya. We will open the floor for questions and discussion a little bit later. Now we would like to hear from our speakers. And please mark your questions, if any question to speaker. Now I would like to invite Stephanie and to see how real science diplomacy in your field, where you are expert, it's developing. How much we should take care of this important issue in science?
Thank you. Thank you very much for your nice comments. Thank you for the introduction. And really, I'm absolutely thrilled to be here today representing my institution, Sciences Po in Paris. I feel like I'm a little bit a usual suspect here, because our university is fully and only a social science and humanities university, which I think it might be a little specific to you, meaning we're not a comprehensive university. We do not teach natural sciences. We only teach humanities and social sciences. To be completely honest, I have to say we used to, because starting from this year, we are integrating in our curriculum natural sciences through new diplomas. One is called the Bachelor of Arts and Science, for example, and we do teach now science diplomacy. And the reason why I'm telling you these two aspects is to tell you that how did we, you know, come to the conclusion that we should open up to a truly transdisciplinary perspective to science. First of all, we reflected, and actually it's interesting to see that Sciences Po has been founded at the end of the 19th century, in 1872, at a time when sociologists wanted to work, and actually the founder of Sciences Po, his name is Boutmy, he's a founder of sociology as a science, and at that time, his colleagues considered that transdisciplinary work were really works in between natural sciences and social sciences. So actually, I think at the beginning of the 21st century, we are reinventing something which existed at the end of the 19th century, which is basically to do truly transdisciplinary work from a very, very base disciplinary work as well. What the point I want to make is we came to science diplomacy, we came to the idea that we needed to train diplomats, because that's very much what we do at Sciences Po, training diplomats in sciences, not only because we believe that social sciences is a decoration, not only that, because we believed it gives you a little bit of general culture and as a way of considering the world and life, maybe representation of things, but social sciences have a lot to say to the, you know, issues that we face today, whether it's about ethics in science, it's about AI, trustworthy AI. I don't know whether Mr. Chatila is in the room today, but he's working with us on this project. Basically, it's not only to give ethics to science, a little bit of culture, but it's truly to help scientists, including natural scientists, producing their sciences. So we believe that for the future of social sciences and to challenge ourselves to make sure that social sciences will be able to tell something about what's going on in the world, we need to work with natural scientists. We need to work all together. We also believe that diplomacy and international relations are changing very much, and we do need to understand how does that change. What are the different actors involved? And because we quite understand, you know, the way international relations work, we also believe that we can help natural scientists in doing science diplomacy, because we do understand the different challenges of diplomacy ahead of us. So to put it, continue on what I would like to say, so what did we do? Basically, we launched in May, and Mr. Bourguignon was part of this scheme. We launched in May an initiative, so it's very humble. We call it an initiative. We want to be European, so we called it a European Initiative on Science Diplomacy, getting together people who we believe are hybrids. So we are like hybrid cars, we are hybrid scientists, meaning people who do not only understand both sides, but also people who might have been actors in both fields. I take my simple example, so I'm a political scientist and lawyer by training, but also have been a scientific attaché for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs based in China. So I can somehow talk a little bit from an academic perspective and also from within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So we try to bring together people who have different experiences and are hybrid, so they can also talk from different perspectives. We also want to make sure that we are not too Eurocentric, although it's a European initiative, because we know that there are new scientific superpowerhouses that are coming from, you know, Brazil, Russia, China, South Africa, and we want to know what are their perspectives. And therefore, I'm so happy to be here and join, for me, the first time, the World Science Forum, because I can see how diverse are the participants, and that's exactly what I think we should know. We really want to emphasize on the importance of social sciences and humanities and science diplomacy. And we also want to emphasize the fact that science diplomacy is also to produce science. It's not only to produce a political agenda, it's to help science to be, you know, basically produced. So we are at the very beginning, and I will just finish by this. So we have open new courses. They're pilot project classes at the master level for young future diplomats. In my class, there are 25 of them from 17 different nationalities from all continents. They're going to take the exams as diplomats in their countries. And for the first time, they will have, you know, Sciences Po diploma with a course in science diplomacy. And we explore what is science diplomacy and more than that, what it should be, hoping that the next generations of science diplomats will be, you know, empowered with the idea of changing things from within. So we are going to assess this class and to open a new concentration for next year. We will have a big meeting in January. We are sponsored by the Commissioner, Carlos Muedas, the European Commissioner of Higher Education and Science, who will leave his work at the beginning of December. And I hope to be back next year to see you soon, or keep on, you know, having contacts with you, so I can tell you a little bit more what is happening on this quite interesting initiative on science diplomacy from a social science perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. It was really quite exciting to know about this European initiative, and I hope we could a little bit more elaborate these things during the discussion. Next, I would like to ask Jean-Pierre to speak about the Europe as a whole, and because of many years you are chairing this, one of the important organizations, and I remember when it was started, it was an exciting period for all science in Europe. And today, I think, as everybody agrees, that it's 100 years existed, European Research Council, and gives a wonderful, real opportunity for European scientists to work together. I would like to hear it.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and also a nice introduction to the European Research Council, ERC. Actually, my main point I would like to touch is really, I think it's very important for when you discuss these issues to really take the institutional point of view and the individual researcher point of view. And of course, what is interesting is when the two meet. From the institutional point of view, actually, it was very appropriate to celebrate 100 years of official recognition. And there have been various activities under this. And of course, for institutions, you need time to organize yourself, to really make the organization efficient, to really do things properly. And there is one organization which was not mentioned, which I think I would like to bring to your attention, but I'm sure many of you already heard about it, which is called the Global Research Council, which was really an initiative which was started by Professor Subra Suresh when he was the director of the U.S. National, the NSF, UN National Science Foundation, but also followed up and supported by a number of organizations funding funding organizations in the world, in particular the German ones. And this Global Research Council now meets every year, and the last meeting was in São Paulo in Brazil. The first time it was actually in the Southern Hemisphere, and also interestingly, we have met in various places, and each time the number of participants, a number of agencies or number of funding agencies present is growing. So at this moment in São Paulo, there were more than 60 such agencies present. So of course, it's funding agencies are very important because they provide the resources for the researchers. But just to show an example that at some point, some people and felt the necessity of confronting the various difficulties that the researchers are facing or the agent, the structures which fund the research are facing, and maybe coming up also with some joint challenges. And some of them are very much connected to the theme here about ethics. Some have to do with gender balance. Some have to do with the open science. And so there have been a number of such topics which each time are an opportunity to really confront how these issues or these challenges are faced in the various environment. So this was the contribution I wanted to give from the side of the institutions. But I want also to discuss it from the side of a scientist. And then to put it, then this will be give me an opportunity to say a few words about ERC. Because one thing we face basically in every country is to obtain from the people who decide, who in the end are most of the time politicians, to agree that giving the initiative to researchers is very important. That is to let really have, of course, there are necessity because there are challenges that to have some top-down research, but also extremely important that there is also some bottom-up research where the only thing you want is to challenge the researchers to come up with their best ideas, their most daring ideas, and without telling them in advance what they should be looking for. And I think this was the motivation of a number of European scientists to get the ERC going. But I think it's in the context of science diplomacy also very important that at the world level, we still accept the idea that a number of things which will change the world are going to come from initially from individual researchers. Of course, they will have to resonate and really mobilize colleagues and get things done. But I think it's extremely important from that point of view that this space, such a space exists. And this is a permanent battle. So this is my last point I want to discuss, because in my function as president of ERC, I have, of course, this great privilege of interacting with scientists doing all kinds of sciences and, of course, with their great ideas. So this is a fantastic privilege. But at the same time, to try and convince the politicians that this is our scheme is the right one, namely to trust, to empower the researchers. And this is, I must say, a very permanent battle, because for many politicians, for good reasons, actually, the horizon is the next election if you're in a democratic country. And of course, it's a very short horizon. And so to take the long view, which is really what science is about in many, many cases, because we know that the change of paradigm that some scientists bring takes decades to be recognized. And if you look today as the use of GPS and the correction of GPS connected general relativity, of course, this was not in the mind of Einstein when he designed general relativity. It was a completely different setting. But you have to accept that these long views can make really a difference. So this interaction between how institutions can make sure that these contributions from individual scientists, which in the end are completely adopted by the scientific community, are taken on board, is something which requires permanent attention, and really we have to share experience. And that's where science diplomacy or science cooperation makes a big difference. And for many of us scientists, for myself, for example, having the possibility of spending time in other countries than my own country, France, was decisive for my own career. And I hope this can continue in the future, that a lot of young researchers will be exposed to this, to the way science is done elsewhere from your own basis, because that's very decisive for your own development. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jean-Pierre, for highlighting the specific issues which is a concern of yours and the concern of the European future European science cooperation and so on, and we will discuss these things in a few minutes in more detail. And now I would like to invite Alexander Hunov. Please tell, within the very short period of time, it was really exciting that the Russian science waited when the Russian science will be sponsored at the really high level, when the really best peer review system will be established in the system of the Russian science. And in 2014, when the first call was set up, it's not,
you know, we need magic.
Magic, yes. Maybe if we will move here, it will show. Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
Great. Well, it's just some impression about this, your work within this period of time and what you achieved in terms of the international cooperation. Thank you.
First of all, I would like to thank World Science Forum organizers for inviting me to speak about the value of international cooperation in research, in particular from Russian Science Foundation perspective. As you can see, the Russian science has been in a positive track for a few past years. Especially in engineering, medicine, and chemistry, and such a rapid increase in recent research output may look almost like a credit card boom. And it's generally accepted that dramatic growth may be ineffective, unhealthy, unsustainable, and more risky than slow-paced growth. We share such concerns too in this publication quest. We strive for superior quality in research. Since its foundation in 2014, we are young, we are childhood, Russian Science Foundation has been focused on enhancing research excellence and leadership in Russia. Research by its nature is an exciting, truly international exercise, and thereby we are in charge of building globally competitive Russian research capacity for the global collaboration that will impact and bring value to the whole world. On each of my slides, on the upper hand, you can see the three key words: transparency, competence, result. These are our core values, but we can certainly add one more word: globe. Because more than 6,000 breakthrough research projects we funded in the past 5 years, with all possible transparency, expertise, and result orientation, are for benefit of all people around the globe. Many of these projects drive international collaboration further. On our side, we encourage such collaboration. Russian Science Foundation-funded projects are supposed to go international. International cooperation is fundamental to high-quality research and business innovation. Through global partnerships, today we have only 8 strategic partners in Europe and Asia. We participate in a number of bilateral funding schemes that provide assistance to the best Russian researchers to participate in collaborative research projects with researchers abroad. Based on mutual principle of excellence, parity funding, credible independent peer review, and mutual trust. Our internal analysis provides evidence that all these collaborative projects perform 20 or 25% better compared to the national research projects in the term of quality of research output. International groups of scientists addressed more ground challenges, more ambitious research tasks that cannot be solved by the efforts of a single nation. Often there is a greater transdisciplinary in a global research conduct. That is another source of excellence. One fine example is a study of ancient hominid Denisovan that originated as a basic archaeology project funded by the Russian Science Foundation. Through engagement of collaborators from Max Planck Institute of Germany, Oxford University in UK, Hebrew University in Israel, specializing in groundbreaking ancient DNA sequencing techniques, its results had impact of a global scale. The discovery of Neanderthal Denisovan hybrid is an exciting new development of origins of modern humans. Now a new project with backing from European Research Council aims to transform our knowledge to Denisovans and their relations with both Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. Next, the excellence in research funding comes from the contribution of a diverse pool of independent peer reviews with various backgrounds ideas. What was interesting to us in the report, Grand Peer Review in Focus, that is an extensive global Grand Peer Review survey released by Publons last month, was the truly global range of funders. These more than 4,000 researchers participating in the survey had engaged with, and Russian Science Foundation appeared on the top 10 list of more than 800 funders from 195 countries. Today, in our review process, we used an internal database of more than 6,000 highly qualified reviews, including over 1,000 honorary contributors from around the globe, representing more than 50 countries. Each of them ensures the highest quality, credibility, and public trust in research we fund. With our competitive grant programs tailored to the needs of researchers on the different stage of their career, we are committed to implement cutting-edge research projects. In 2018, we received 175 applications from projects investigators residing outside Russia and 265 applications involving foreign scientists as a co-contributors of the project. It's not a large long grants on exceptionally flexible terms offered by the Russian Science Foundation are the main attraction of these applications. Russia has much to offer to the brightest and curious minds of the world. First of all, world renewed infrastructure for mega science, its rich biodiversity, extensive biobanks, and others. Let me add one more final consideration. This session is also devoted to the science of diplomacy, and since we are living in politically turbulent times with rising populist and spread of the fake news, it's vitally important that we adhere to the evidence-based practice and scientifically proven decision-making. As a premier research funder in Russia, we are building a new knowledge in science frontiers that can be effectively and equitably shared with all the world. Thank you very much for your attention and your time.
Thank you very much, Sausage. Okay. Thank you, for introduction, for really the understanding it's all these operations in international relation in your foundation, bridging the Russian science with the rest of the world. Now I would like to invite Yelena to give a few words about the international cooperation, not only at the level of scientists, but at the national level. How you bridge nations in terms of the best science available today in the area of climate research, in the area of weather, etc. And I just a brief introduction. The International Meteorological Organization existed since the 19th century and was one of the first organizations to establish a relationship with the International Research Council and later with ICSO. That's why you could see during the whole history, a lot of programs developed by these two organizations. That's now, yes,
please, yes. I'll stay here for the sake of difference. It was a pleasure working with such moderators. He almost said everything I planned to say in his intro and right now. it's a huge honor to be here, and thanks for inviting. Real honor. This room, this spiritual place, the people, what the topics you discuss. Thank you very much. And the time you gave us, 5 minutes, is really challenging, but my predecessors were not very disciplined. I'm going to be probably five and a half minutes also. You think it's just quite difficult to say about the organization which I represent proudly, which is 146 years old. So, we are all about international cooperation. That's all we do. That's our main mandate. But we are also a normative organization, standard maker, global regulator, and application organization of weather, climate, water, environmental, all parameters to the society. Today, WMO is the one who either leads or coordinates or provides directly support all major conventions. Climate Convention, Ozone Convention, Biodiversity, Sustainable Development Goals, most of them. It was not always like this. When WMO was created 546 years ago, the main reason was maritime navigation. That is where the nations should work together to pass the ships through the borders. Then later on, aviation added as a sector. So that was really the need for the countries to cooperate. That was the reason for creation of the IMO, International Met Organization, at that time NGO, which then transferred to the Intergovernmental Specialized Agency of the United Nations in 1950. All this time, and at least 75 years back, I can track from my records and the history I know, this organization was working hand in hand with ICSU and its predecessors and unions. And that is one of the keys to success. National meeting in a minute. But at that time, it was crucial that researchers come together with those who do operations. By the way, happy birthday, 100 years. We changed the name, but we remain the same. Happy birthday, really. So I probably say what I needed to conclude with, what is the future? Because then I will give you just three examples from all this long history of excellent experiences my organization had to just illustrate why what I want, going to say now it matters. What is the future? Future is Earth system, multidisciplinary, cross-disciplinary studies. Only like this, because everything is now connected. Future is an impact-based, risk-based decision-making. It's not sufficient anymore to provide physical parameters. Decision makers need to know what to do with this, and how much risk. Science to policy needs to be very well organized. It needs to be coherent, consistent, and robust. And that we know from our own skin, from the process we run on IPCC assessments. So probably the three essential things would be our future. It's no longer sufficient to publish article in a peer-reviewed journal and then to count number of citations. We know how scientists work. I was a scientist myself. I say I was because now I'm administering science. But it's not sufficient anymore. This needs to be taken further. And I think this synergy of WMO and ICSU and its predecessor and its successor, ISC, demonstrates how this can be done. Just three examples, quite briefly. One is ozone. Alec already mentioned that WMO and ICSU collaborated on International Geophysical Year. It was 62 years ago. WMO before that had, by the way, two other International Polar Years. 160 years ago, thanks very much. That's very kind of you. International Geophysical Year gave a birth to the Global Ozone Measurement System. Global Ozone Observing System. It didn't exist before. 60 years ago it was established. Then research groups were established. We started seeing ozone depletion in the stratosphere. Scientists made several intergovernmental statements on that through WMO. Still no reaction. Because there was no impact clearly seen. And then there was a burst of the health communities and WMO Health Organization detecting that in the southern hemisphere, because of ozone hole in Antarctica, and now we know, there were too much of cataracts and skin cancer, so health impacts. The effect, creation of Vienna Convention 32 years ago, Vienna Convention, and Montreal Protocol. Research stopped? No, not at all. Research, ozone research managers continued with WMO coordination every year to provide advice to the policymakers. At the end, last assessment, it took 30 years to stop depletion. So we already are on the peak past. But now the last assessment published in last year, 2018, says, okay, we are already on recovery stage, but it will take a few decades to full recovery to the level before the convention was set. It's 40 more years. So that is the whole thing, you know. It's not just sufficient to see one or two group of scientists saying this is important because they send us back and say, go back and do further studies. We now understand how to bring it up through the policy processes and how to really see the effect of this. So the second, absolutely unprecedented, one of the jewels of the history of WMO is the creation of the World Weather Watch. After International Geophysical Year, no one knew how to exchange the data. There was a lot of information collected. Nations tried to cooperate, to exchange the data, to have access to all the data. There was no such system which could possibly pull this all together and provide access to everyone else. So it was reason number one. And reason number two, the satellites, which you Alec mentioned. There were the satellites started being launched, and United Nations got kind of concern, okay, what is this to do with this outer space exploration? And then turned the heads to WMO and said, okay, this is the right organization to take care of this. And at that time in 1963, the three of two brilliant scientists, Wexler and Bugayev, American and Russian, during the Cold War, sat together and created something which now works as an amazing system. Global public good system, which collects information from everywhere in the world. Every country in real time provide observation, exchange freely, unrestrictively. Everyone can access it. Moreover, there is a system of production, the forecasting system, because it's not sufficient just to have the observation, you need to know what to do with observations. Every country makes a contribution and gets access to the result of the numerical weather prediction or forecasting systems which are there. So that took 55 years, but this is now working as a one global public good system which connects everybody. Everybody is dependent on everyone else. As we speak, Iran exchanges information with the United States, Cuba with I don't know who. I mean, whatever happens in the country, this exchange never interrupts. Because everyone knows that no one, even very wealthy country, very strong country, even European Union, cannot do it alone. Because they are dependent on other information. So that is the one. And the last is climate switch, which I cannot explain all I would like to say about the climate, but just a few tips on the topic of our today discussion. So this World Weather Watch allowed us to detect, to see what the state is. It was not sufficient for us in climate scale to use only current information. We need predictions. We need to know why the state is like this, why it is changing, and what will be the future. So that led a model development. So that is really rocket science, which WMO is proudly leading with the research groups and with operational groups. The UK Met Office operates the most powerful computer in the world. The most powerful computer in the world. We are really computer heavy as a community, as a discipline, but it was not always like that. So the model development allowed us to understand the energy balance, to understand how energy transfers from one place to another, and for that we needed to know water cycle. And then we started seeing the future. We started doing projections and predictions, and that allowed the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, from the very first assessment 30 years ago, they celebrated birthday last year, from the very first assessment which said it's likely that humans causing climate change, to come to the absolutely clear statement and the fifth assessment in 2015 to say this is inequivocable. So that was a game changer. That helped UNFCCC to finally come up to Paris Agreement, which has been negotiated for 25 years, just negotiation. Now, 4 years after, are we done? No, we are not. Climate is not a physical state. Climate is no longer a geophysical issue. It is now economic issue, it's affordability issue, and it's an issue of multiple risks. So do we need more science? Yes, of course. But just let me conclude. I think this is a recipe to getting right science into the heads of decision makers and make them act. For that, we need multidisciplinary. For that, we need to tell them what happens with everything, with health, with production of agriculture products, with water management, with all of that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elena. It's really going with a few excellent examples into the international cooperation and how it helps society. Thank you. It's really a very important look, not only how non-governmental body, but also intergovernmental body work for the international research cooperation. Atish, when Nobel Prize laureate Abdus Salam established International Center for Theoretical Physics, I think he kept in mind international science cooperation, international cooperation for education, science education in less developed countries, less affluent countries, by those who have the great scientific expertise. And also at that time, at the time of the Cold War, he brought the West-East and bridge West-East with North-South. That was a very special case. And it's more than 50 years nowadays, ICTP exists and showed the brilliancy in science and science education. Could you please tell something more about it? I'll close it.
Touch again.
Yeah, it's a magic. Okay.
Okay, Well, thank you for this opportunity to speak at this prestigious forum. And as Alec mentioned, I would tell you briefly about ICTP and then what general lessons we can for international cooperation that we can draw from this. So ICTP is a world-class research education and center for research and education, and it's a successful model of international cooperation, as you can see, located at this very beautiful place in Trieste. And the vision of SALAM was that science is a common heritage of all humankind, and ICTP has a very unique global mission to promote international cooperation through excellence in science at the frontiers of fundamental sciences. And it has an enviable track record of accomplishments over the past 5 decades, both in pure sciences and in organized international cooperation and science diplomacy, which is the topic today. And the main idea is to bring the world together into the great stream of science, breaking barriers of geography, race, economics, and gender. And I would say that ICTP has performed admirably on this. So very briefly, I will run you through, in view of the time. We are, genetically, we are an international organization. We were founded together with the International Atomic Energy Agency, then United Nations, UNESCO, and the Italian government, and we are governed by a tripartite agreement as a UNESCO Category 1 institute. We have several research areas which were slowly, organically added, starting with high energy and cosmology. SALAM himself worked on high energy physics, so do I. But it slowly grew into condensed matter, mathematics, applied physics, earth system physics, quantitative life sciences. We have a broad spectrum now. We excel, I mean, so the idea is not to be just a service institute, to have very high quality of research. For example, there were 5 ICTP's work has contributed to 5 Nobel Prizes, including work on climate, fundamental physics, and ATLAS, and so on. So this is part of our excellence in science. But the other part is reaching out to the world, which was what SALAM, he was from Pakistan, and he wanted all the opportunities to be available to the talent that is around the globe. So we organize 60 conferences and workshops each year. The top people from each field come from all over the world. It's really north, south, east, west collaboration. We have 8 postgraduate programs, laboratory trainings, career development, diploma program. And as you can see, for example, the course that I teach in advanced quantum field theory has students from all 10 different countries, from Ethiopia. It's a very interesting experience to teach such a class from Palestine, Lebanon. ICTP has a long tradition of scientific capacity building in developing countries. We have an Office of External Activities, so we get scientists who are working in the developing country to come and spend time to just refresh their toolkit and get, again, exchange their ideas with the broad community of scientists at large. We have now 4 partner institutes so that we can perform locally what ICTP has been doing globally, one in Brazil, one in China, one in Rwanda, and one sort of coming up in Mexico. We have a very wonderful, very interesting program called Physics Without Frontiers. One of the, Kate is sitting here. So we go to various countries, several countries, like 10, 15 countries, and we address master students, least developed countries, from Colombia to Jordan, and where the physics may not be so developed. And many of them have gone on to do physics research, have come to our master's program in Trieste. We have a science dissemination unit. So just to give you an idea, I mean, over the years, something like 150,000 scientists have visited ICTP. I mean, really the best scientists from all over the world, from all countries. And as you can see, it covers essentially the whole, I mean, we have all, essentially 187 countries have visited. Somebody from there in science has developed, high science has visited ICTP. We have several affiliated centers, network hubs, scientific meetings, schools and workshops all over the world. So we have also impact on international science. This we were selected as the International Center of Excellence. We have a very strong program in climate modeling. One of our, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Sciences was headed by one of our physicists, which got the Nobel Prize. So we do contribute to decision making in this manner by contributing expertise. We now have started a new program called Medical Physics, and it's very interesting. It's Atoms for Peace. So many countries actually, for example, I think in Colombia, I forget the country, El Salvador, the first medical physician in the entire country was actually trained in this master's program, because if you need x-rays and so on for medical physics, you need a physicist who understands them. So let me now briefly touch upon, so this is a very, very fast summary of what ICTP does. But let me just say, relating to the topic of this forum, what has made ICTP so successful, and why does it work, and how can we, what lessons can we draw? So I think the general lesson is that the culture of science, I mean, in the today's world of post-truth and everything, it's very important to pay attention to developing the culture of science, and the ethical engagement comes through that, because science is a unique human enterprise that is naturally global and democratic, with very high standards of integrity within the community. It is a shared language that transcends national boundaries, and it naturally provides a common platform for dialogue. It's a fundamental human need to understand how the universe works. And moreover, nature always acts as an external arbiter that overrides ideology. So you cannot just say, because the president of my country believes in this, you should do this. Whatever science tells you, you have to listen to it. And it has an enormous transformative potential, not only through technology, but just as a way of looking at the world with respect for fact and a kind of a humility to be guided by evidence, which I think is more and more important in today's world. And I think I've told you about all our wonderful programs, but I think one of the most important institutions at ICTP is the cafe. We of course have very excellent coffee. But it really brings together, I mean, it's a kind of a symbol, you could say. It brings together scientists from all over the world. You'll often see scientists from India and Pakistan, Iran and USA, Lebanon, Israel, engaged in a lively scientific conversation. So it's a unique forum for kind of soft diplomacy and international cooperation, where friendships develop, people just bounce off ideas. I mean, one good example, and it really brought together East, West, North, South, even during the days of Iron Curtain. Some of the best papers from the Soviet physicists I read were possible because those physicists visited ICTP when I was a student, and those could be translated and made available to the international community. For example, the idea of a cooperative center in Middle East was sort of nurtured at ICTP. It was mooted in 1983. And it was kind of nurtured in this atmosphere of ICTP and the 3SD system at a time when it was dismissed as a kind of a pipe dream. But it was realized eventually in 2017 when the Sesame Synchrotron facility opened in Alan, Jordan, under the auspices of UNESCO. So it's a kind of a, you can see, you have scientists coming from Pakistan, Egypt, Iran, Jordan, Turkey, Israel, Palestine, all going to Jordan. And this kind of a international cooperation would not have been possible if there was no forum where people first could meet and bounce off ideas and say, okay, of course, many, many people have worked on it. ICTP was only a kind of incubator, you could say. But you require places like ICTP to initiate such projects. And that way, ICTP has been a major anchor for a cluster of international scientific organizations in the 3SD area. For example, 3SD University, International School for Advanced Study, CSIT is called, the World Academy of Sciences, Electra, Synchrotron, facility, International Center for Genetic Engineering, Biotechnology, and Observatory. They all sort of, there was a kind of a synergy developed and a very symbiotic 3SD science system evolved because of the existence of ICTP. And it's because of that that the 3SD was declared as a science city in Europe and was awarded the Euroscience Open Forum with the motto, Freedom for Science and Science for Freedom. And I think that really encapsulates the mission of ICTP and how successfully we have carried it over the past many years and how we can take it forward. Yeah, so I think the way it fits into international science cooperation and science diplomacy is just by allowing people the freedom to think and the freedom to pursue their... I would just end with this very nice poem of Rabindranath Tagore that the Indian laureate, that you can read it for yourself. It says that where knowledge is free and where the world has not been broken up into narrow domestic walls, and that's exactly what ICTP aims to do, that it breaks down these narrow domestic walls and brings the world together. So I'll stop here.
Thank you very much, Atish. It's really exciting thing that you showed as the last slide. Thank you for the presentation. I would like to tell that we develop a really big program for this session, but time running, it's really so fast. May I just slightly change what we plan and the open discussion? Elisa, it's okay, open discussion, because it's, we have no time for internal discussion we wanted to have. If any questions, and I think there are microphones, yes. Yeah, yes, please. You are second, okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for the nice discussion. My name is Mustafa, I'm from Marie Curie Alumni Association. I have two questions, one to our Professor Baum, regarding the career path in science diplomacy. Yesterday we had a session where the speaker suggested that there is no straightforward path for a natural scientist to go and pursue a career in science diplomacy. So what's your thought on that, or what's your suggestion on that? And the second question would be to the president of the ISC. This forum is about the ethical responsibility of the scientist. If we look at the global issues, as a scientist, are not we already done our responsibility? We gathered evidence, we communicated our results with the public as well as decision making. I'm specifically talking about climate crisis, but yet the bigger superpowers actually go out from the climate deal. So my questions to you is that as a global organization which is devoted to science, what role ISC could take so that we can actually progress something in case of climate crisis? Thank you.
Maybe one more question and then it will open here for panel to answer. Here, the lady, second row.
Thank you. Thank you to all the panelists, and let me thank the director of the Abdusalam Institute, because in my previous capacity as the Director General of the Ghana India Kofi Annan Center of Excellence in ICT, we had excellent cooperation with you. Right now, in the work I do, we are more concerned about data science and the ethical implications of data science. I was fascinated to hear about the models that Madam Elena shared with us, but those timelines are not very realistic if we talk about tech. We can't look at 40 years before we figure out how to work together to address the ethical issues, for example, in artificial intelligence. And what we see is there's a total lack of balance. Those scientists in the field tell me that for the high-level research in data science, the resource material that you need, the data that you need, is concentrated in very few hands, and those hands are in the private sector. How do you see us working in terms of diplomacy in this area? There's been a lot of debate at the one UN meeting I was at. There was a whole lot of discussion. The UN should not be involved. This is a private sector issue. Regulation is going to stifle innovation, the usual arguments. But at the same time, we know that for multi-stakeholder dialogue, we need all stakeholders. How is it that we're really going to address this tough issue? We keep talking about the environment, but this is affecting the society.
Thank you. Stephanie, I will invite you to answer the first question.
Yeah. I should push. I know it's here, it's over here. Okay. No. Do you see I'm a social science person, no? Thank you for your question about the so-called science diplomats. So I'm going to give you a few answers. First of all, someone wrote somewhere that diplomats and scientists are not natural bedfellows, and I think these can be changed for sure. So there are many ways to answer to your question. First point, there is a classic diplomacy. Basically, in two different kinds of ministries, whatever the country you live in, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Ministry of Higher Education and Research. And we can train diplomats so they can find a way, a job in both of these ministries. Usually, at the bilateral level of science diplomacy, there is a big problem because there is no connection between Ministry of Higher Education and Ministry of Foreign Affairs. This needs to be challenged and this needs to change. And it's true for European countries, and I understand it's true everywhere. Now you have the non-classic diplomacy aspect, which is the basically NGOs, international NGOs, global diplomacy, and science diplomats exist. They do find jobs in these, you know, alternative way of diplomacy. Another thing is, we talk a lot about diplomacy in science in diplomacy, but I think we need to work on diplomacy in science, meaning scientific institutions need to have scientific agendas, and they need to be part of the global political agenda, and they need to work on this. And my last and fourth point is that actually now diplomats need to be experts, and they need to specialize. You have many kinds of diplomacies. You have climate diplomacy. You even can think of a vaccine diplomacy during the Ebola crisis, for example, meaning that diplomats need also to focus and to be experts on. Therefore, what we are trying to do at the French level, which I'm only responsible for, is to maybe have in the exam that diplomats take a series of questions in science and also a sort of track and field in science. So this is, you know, there are propositions. It's a long way, but we... And I do think that very interesting propositions will come from the non-P5 countries. Countries, we are not, you know, United Nations permanent members because they have new, I mean, they start this idea of science diplomats from scratch, and they have new ideas, very interesting ideas that we can implement. I hope I understand your question.
Daya?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for that question. So, to paraphrase it very briefly, your question is about responsibility, what exactly is the scope of and the range of responsibility? How is that understood? How is it understood in the International Science Council, and what are we doing about it? So I should say, first of all, that advocating for freedom and responsibility in science is one of the major missions of the International Science Council. We have a huge project that is about to take off with the very simple title, Freedom and Responsibility in the 21st Century. In other words, let us examine what exactly we mean by freedom and responsibility in the 21st century. And it is different. There are various issues that had not been in play, you know, perhaps a generation ago. Coming to specific responsibilities, in addition to those that you had mentioned, we do have a responsibility as scientists to convey scientific results, achievements, and the like, not only to policymakers, but to the broader public. Now, that's perhaps easier said than done if one considers the technical nature of many scientific developments. Nevertheless, it is an issue that we must address, so that we have a general public that is able to engage with science, that has science presented to it in a comprehensible way. That is important in and of itself,
But in addition, consider the world that we are living in, a world of pseudoscience, of anti-scientific views, whether it has to do with climate change or genetic modification. Broader society needs to be in a position in which, it is able to identify or determine the difference between bona fide good science based on consensus on the one hand and pseudoscientific views which are often propagated from ideological perspectives. So that's extremely important. Just a final point about a further responsibility within the context of the International Science Council. That is to provide the scientific perspective and input into the various projects and programs that address the Sustainable Development Goals. Well, of course, we are not unique in that respect, but again, we have a major program in that respect. We have a formal role in the UN system through what's called the Major Group, together with the World Federation of Engineering Organizations, through which and the Major Group provides the channel of communication with the UN system, with the member states, as I said, to provide the scientific perspective and input to the SDGs. Thank you.
Thank you. Elena, you would like to?
Thank you very much. On the private data, I think I would just refer to what Daya just said. So private sector and public sector will start working together, I think, in the future very soon in a more coherent way. Because Sustainable Development Goals framework assumes that everyone should be on board. It's not just governments only. It's non-state players. It's public and private sector. It's many. Regarding data, WMO is very special here. And I can only talk about the data WMO takes care of. It's like physical parameters measurement. For us, because we are a standard-making organization, there is a certain set of data which is absolutely critical for saving lives. So that is why we have a set of technical standards, which is international commitment, and it's obligation of the every state which is member of WMO, which is 193, to deliver those data. Otherwise, it creates critical deficiency and everyone else at risk. Private sector doesn't want to be an enemy. They want to contribute. They want to be a player together with the weather services and research institutions in our domain. But when it comes to service provision and data, they kind of think that they can hold on what they get for themselves because it's a potential to generate additional value. This will change in our domain quite soon. We have started public-private dialogue and we explained the rules of the game to all interested players in this area, and we said if we don't have that exchange, it doesn't make sense to have it at all. So there should be global exchange, absolutely. So I think it's not easy too, but in our discipline, we do have a means to address it. Also, just on this opportunity, I would pick up also the model, something I didn't say, but I just like to probably say it, maybe someone is interested. IPCC fifth assessment cycle, the models we projected, it's we call special project, which runs several projections. It's a model intercomparison project. Yeah, for the last fifth assessment cycle, they have run about 100 kilometer more or less resolution. This is not sufficient to understand the regional component. So we really need much finer resolution. And right now, for the sixth assessment cycle, they are trying to run 30-kilometer resolution. So in models, if you double the spatial resolution, it increases 10 times computational power resource. So it's very, very costly business. And these models are not just operational models which WMO has for our routine climate prediction purpose. There are also many research models which come on board. So they created a huge amount of this modeling demand and information. They don't cope with this. So they need help and investment. If somebody is interested in this, I can talk more about that. Thank you.
Okay, I had thought I would put comments to several of you, but since time is over, I just would like to make two general comments. First of all, we have been just mentioning the progress of collaboration for over a century, yet we also observe today the so-called neo-nationalism, where some governments put limits to science exchange and to scientist mobility. I wonder how can we mobilize to enforce the cosmopolitan idea of science, which is to bring the best of science to benefit all nations. That's my first observation. The second concerns transdisciplinarity. I mean, Professor Bourguignon is a mathematician, yet his work has been extremely relevant to we all who work with social inequality, economists and social science as well. But I think that this idea of transdisciplinarity is still in its infancy. It's hard for some people to conceive that social science is also science. When we talk about science systems, sometimes we restrict ourselves to the so-called hard science, yet the problems the humanity face concern so much the social science that we think we must enforce, we have to move ahead in terms of transdisciplinarity. That's my two general comments.
If we have a more question, because it's actually, we are very close to the end of the session. Question is here. Stephanie, you would like?
I would need 30 seconds to talk about
yes,
two of
please,
my colleagues,
please,
but
yeah,
after questions. After questions.
If there's any questions. Actually, I have a specific question to Jean-Pierre about this. During the discussion, it came quite evident that there are knowledge, which is definitely delivered by a community of scientists to society, but not all this knowledge used, usable, and useful. Some of them even sometimes not understood by the policymakers, by the society at large, like you mentioned. What is the view, your view, how to make this process, this process of the understanding of the scientific deliverers better, how to make more scientific achievements be used by society?
Thank you. I think you are touching a very serious challenge because it has to do, first of all, with the basic training of people. If you look around in the world, what is the typical background of people who are in power in various positions? Actually, very few of them have a training which has anything to do with science. And if you look at the composition of the Congress in the US or in France, the Assemblée Nationale, or basically every country, I mean, very, very few have any basic training in science. So this is already, to start with, the handicap that you are also having people who have been exposed to completely different things in their initial training. The second one, which is the one I mentioned, which has to do also with the, in a sense, the time frame in which people are operating. And it's very, very important for me that to obtain that people accept the idea that if you really want to achieve something, at some point you have to accept to take some risk. And of course, if you don't take risks, you don't really make breakthroughs. So this is the other dimension which is difficult, that is in particular with public funding, because public funding, at some point, you have to be accountable. And being accountable, it's easier to say, well, I'm going to fund things I'm sure which will be successful. But most of the time, if you do that, actually, you are doing things which are not really going to be disruptive. You are going to do things which are okay, but not the ones who are going to make a difference. So these are the challenges we have to face. And I must say, one effort we made at the level of European Research Council has been really to work as closely as we could with the European Parliament. Because definitely, first of all, there were a group of members of European Parliament who were definitely keen on being exposed to science. And we tried to provide, and within the parliament, with activities of this nature. And many parliaments have actually groups of this nature. In France, there is a specific group dealing with that, and I'm sure that other parliaments have too. And I think this could be a good way of penetrating the parliament, except one thing I could witness in the French parliament, for example, is that the bonds between the members of these groups, the independently of their political orientation, was much stronger than their own bonds with the people from their political parties, which showed that they felt quite isolated. And so we have, this is really a long-term battle, but this is a critical battle. And as scientists, we have to contribute, which means we have to make ourselves available. We have to provide people with the information. And of course, the new media gave us the feeling that maybe this is a fantastic new tool. But the appreciation we can have today is that actually the tool has really turned against us in some way, because it looks like the people who are not really willing to accept the idea of a scientific challenge, scientific discussion, have won over the ones and things which are really fake science seems to occupy more space than the true science in these media. So this is something we need as a collective body to think about. Why is this happening? How can we get against this? And my own answer, and that's will be my final words, is that we really have to take very seriously basic education, and in particular the training of teachers has to be rethought. I think we cannot just train teachers today as we trained them in the past, just because of this completely new environment for which they are in their normal training not exposed at all. And we have to associate the teachers and the much younger generation in a completely new way. I don't think any other way. And of course, this training has to be fundamentally critical.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Jean-Pierre. A few years ago, I met a science diplomacy expert from the Tufts University, Paul Beckman, and I asked, could you please tell me what means science diplomacy? And he looked at me quite carefully because he knew my background. I was not a social scientist. And he told, it is a part of the balancing of between the national interest and global interest. And today, I think we looked at these aspects of the balancing between the national perspective, where we see here some national perspectives, regional perspectives, international perspective, intergovernmental perspectives. And now we have to balance this. Balance to get the best for society. Because again, as I mentioned, we are delivering a lot of knowledge which should be fully used. And I think the science diplomacy can promote it, can promote science for peace, science for society. And with these words, I would like to thank our speakers for wonderful contribution to this session and to the World Science Forum, where the ethics is an important issue. And I think this science diplomacy and ethics are quite close, because it's not something quite independent. We are contributing through international cooperation to the ethics and responsibility. They come together. And I think it's the last comment that comes from Stefania, please, yes. Before we will.
I have to apologize first, I have to think, because it's because of Elise's comment that I thought I could not tell you something very important, I believe, in science diplomacy. So, as I said, I come from Sciences Po, and our university currently is facing the fact that two of our researchers have been imprisoned. They're jailed in Iran. They're jailed since June. We have a Franco-Iranian researcher, Fariba Abdelha, and her partner, Roland Marshall. They're both experts on African studies and Middle East studies, and they have been jailed since June. So in France, we're launching a huge campaign for them, and also for the 16 others who are jailed in the same prison currently. They are all social scientists. They could be natural scientists. But we were talking about science for freedom and freedom for science. I thought that you might share, you know, the same feeling as I have, that, you know, they're scientists. We need, you know, we need to tell their names on a daily basis. We need to fight for their freedom, and they were just doing social sciences in the country where they were, you know, exercising their fieldwork. So if you're interested, I'd be very happy to just send you the link of the old committee that tried to fight for their rights. Maybe the International Science Council can help on this. So Fariba and Roland, today we'll be very happy that we have a thought for them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Everybody.